Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
All right, everyone. I thank you for joining. It's the top of the hour, and it is that time again for another Journal Club session. My name is Dr. Diane Sanders-Cepeda, and I will be your presenter today as we do part two of a clinical deep dive. It has been so much information that has been coming out. So many studies that I know it is probably burdensome for anyone to try to go through all of that information. So I want to try to provide you with at least an overview and an update around some of the leading research that we're seeing hit some of our favorite and maybe not so well-known publications. But like I said, this is barely, there's so much of information and it's so hard to filter through everything. So this is like the tip of the iceberg for things that we're gonna go through. If you advance to the next slide, Shane, this is just the state of the state. You know, we know, and I will ask anyone who's not speaking to put themselves on mute. We know that we, are now at the leading this pandemic with cases. Throughout the United States. Now we're at over 1.5 million, and I believe this was updated at 8:32. I believe this number has already changed. If you proceed to the next slide, what we're seeing in Florida is that we're not increasing at the same rate that we were, but we're still at a total of 47,000 plus cases. In the area that I'm in, we are seeing over 16,000 cases in Miami-Dade is over 6,000 in Broward County. So still a lot, but we do recognize that the trend for new cases has not gone away, but has slowed down. So that is some positive news. When we look at the projections though, if you go to the next slide, because of the uncertainty that we're now seeing around reopening states, I believe all like 49 states are in full reopening mode where they are opening at certain parts of their states, Florida included. You know, this projection of hospital resource use that we've been following has changed a bit. And like I said, that is all around the uncertainty. We don't know what's gonna happen. I know in Broward County, we're already seeing a trend up with new cases. So it is worrisome, something that we are gonna be watching very closely. As we look ahead, I would say, if you go to the next slide for me, there has been some guidance that we've seen now from AMDA and some of the other organizations, the American Geriatric Society, some of our state chapters around reopening. And I wanted to share this with you. It is on AMDA's web page. They put it out in the beginning of the month. And it just speaks to the factors that we need to take into account when we're thinking about post-acute and long-term care. You know, we know that our areas are much more vulnerable. We have not only a high percentage of older patients, but people with chronic conditions. So we do need to take into account. And really, I think what we've been doing is really trying to lean in on our local estate governments and encourage facilities to talk to the hospital systems that they work with, but just as a way to just advocate for what we need to do and keep that in mind. If you go to the next slide for me, this is something I've been following through the New York Times. It is just a map that just shows the reopening. This is updated yesterday. And I just wanted to share it with you because you can see who is reopening on a broader scale, where are there more regional reopenings or partial reopenings in the areas that are shut down. So they update this. It appears that they're updating it every day. So I would encourage you, if you just have time, to just take a look at that page. There's a lot of good, great information that they're putting out. And once again, if you're not speaking, please put yourself on mute. If you go to the next slide for me, this is just a policy statement that AMDA put out on the 18th, which was Monday. And it describes testing strategies that we should consider. So it really is speaking that on how testing strategies should be tailored to the clinical situation. Is not recommending that all in every situation, everyone get tested, but you really need to evaluate your community, look at what's happening in the facilities that you may be taking patients from, look at what's happening in your county and make those determinations. So this was added to their page on the 18th, which, like I said, was Monday. If we keep going, you know, I want to spend the majority of our time in the clinical deep dive. So if you advance to the next slide, Shane, there has been a quote from Dr. Fauci that has sort of stayed with my mind. I heard it on April 16th, and I couldn't shake it. He said at that time, during one of the many broadcasts that he was delivering, that this virus was an extraordinarily efficient virus. And, you know, the first study that I want to talk about, you know, is we have it coming out of JAMA, but I just want to just think about that statement, want you guys to think about it, because in the times that we've seen, like just in the last few days of reopening, we saw a case, the news story break in Arkansas about the 92 individuals who attended a church service, and 35 became positive for COVID-19. You know, a few people are in critical condition right now. We are seeing in Sarasota, Florida, we just saw an outbreak at a nursing facility. We heard last week about the outbreaks in Tampa. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, we're seeing huge outbreaks in nursing facilities, but there's also these pocketed areas as we start reopening and start attending activities that we may start to see. So we just need to keep that in mind. This is not like other viruses. We are still learning about everything, but as we know, our area is very vulnerable. But even thinking about the way the healthcare worker moves through society, you know, there's a big risk when we start considering how we reopen states. So I titled this section on COVID-19, Unfortunately Efficient. And that's because, you know, some studies are we're now seeing just shows how prevalent and the risk that we're seeing. So if you go to the next slide, I wanted to highlight this. I'm not saying that many of our patients are in homeless shelters, but I just thought it was an interesting research letter that hit JAMA. And it was looking at the prevalence of COVID-19 in residents in a large homeless shelter. And they identified a total of 408 individuals in that homeless shelter. And they looked at just over 2 days, April 2nd and April 3rd, they looked at to see how, if anyone was positive for COVID-19. They excluded any residents of this homeless shelter who had already tested positive before the April 2nd and April 3rd date. And what they found was that 147 participants, you know, they actually had 100% participation in getting tested. 147 were tested positive. And it just makes you think about, you know, how large of a prevalence are we seeing? And, you know, with the testing challenges that we've had across the country, what are we missing? This next study was in JAMA on Monday. And this study was conducted to really determine what the prevalence was in this in that area of Los Angeles, where they were seeing about 8,000 confirmed cases. So they did serology tests on 865 individuals. I believe 863 of those samples were able to be actually reviewed. And what they found was that the prevalence for antibodies against the COVID-19 virus was 4.65%. They were able to do some estimates, and the estimates that they made when looking at their calculations, they said if they surveyed everyone in that population, then they were assuming that over 300,000 would have been positive for antibodies from COVID-19. So it suggests that there's a greater prevalence. I think we're all aware of that. A lot of asymptomatic cases that we've heard about. So just, I thought it was an interesting study to come up in JAMA. The next thing I want to talk to you guys about, though, is really the impact to multiple organ systems that we're seeing. So there's been a lot of great research that's come through. The first is a study out of New England Journal of Medicine on cardiovascular disease, drug therapy, and mortality at COVID-19. And this addressed the concern around COVID-19 and disproportionately affecting people with coronary artery disease. It was an observational study. So they looked at 169 hospitals throughout Asia, Europe, and North America. And they identified over 8,910 people. They were able to look at the population that was identified and confirmed that there was an increased risk of in-hospital death amongst those individuals with COVID-19. They did not see any increased risk of death for anyone who was on an ACE inhibitor, but overall having the diagnosis put you at an increased risk. They also looked at, what happened if you had other chronic conditions. So they saw increased risk of death with not only coronary artery disease, but heart failure, cardiac arrhythmias, and COPD. And the population that they saw that was at the greatest risk was those who were over 65. If you turn to the next slide for me, Shane, I've recently become a fan of the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and they have these little snippets of information available where they sort of pull out the top issues, the top items concerning one subject. And so if you get a chance, we're going to put this in our library. I would definitely tell you, if you want something that's a quick read, to read the articles from the little snippet articles from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. So they were looking, okay, if we're out of practice, what are the top things we need to consider for cardiac issues in patients with COVID-19? And I'm just going to share a few. So, what we're seeing and what they were seeing is that cardiac injury is seen in a quarter of the patients admitted with COVID-19. And that does not mean that those patients had a diagnosis of coronary artery disease before. So new onset injury to the myocardium, and that an MI may occur without obstructive coronary artery disease. They also noted that 40% of the COVID-19 deaths were partially attributed to heart failure. So I just thought it was interesting. I think we're well aware that now that there is a huge risk of cardiac injury and cardiac disease, worsening of cardiac disease, worsening of heart failure with COVID-19. If we keep going, the next study really looks at the coagulopathy problem. And this is a correspondence that hit the New England Journal of Medicine recently, and it discusses the hypercoagulable state and the fact that we are seeing more cases of venous thromboembolism with COVID-19. We do see that there's an elevation in the prolongation of activated partial thromboplastin time. And really, when you look at that, the study really addressed the fact that that could be to specific factors or non-specific factors like lupus anticoagulant. So they reviewed 216 positive cases for COVID-19. And what they found is that they were able to look and see that 34 were tested for lupus anticoagulant. And of those 34 samples, 31, which it means 91%, were positive. So there is, as we know, a COVID-19 coagulopathy. And this study is just suggesting that we may need to when we're seeing these patients do lupus anticoagulation as part of the full workup for that coagulopathy. Going to the next study, this is really a review again from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. It is showed that 20 to 55% of patients admitted have evidence of coagulopathy. So I believe when we talked, they did our first deep dive maybe a good month ago, you know, that was still a question. We were trying to figure out how common this is. What we're now seeing come out of the research that's been done in China and Singapore, and some of the research now being done in North America and in Europe, we're seeing that this is a lot more common, you know. And I think that when you look at the factors that are elevated, we do see the elevated D-dimer, we do see the elevated activated PTT, we are seeing PTINR elevation. So we do recognize that there is a COVID-19 coagulopathy. At 20 to 55% of all patients admitted having evidence of coagulopathy is a pretty big number. The coagulopathy that we're seeing is prothrombotic, so it does mean that we do need to anticoagulate these patients. And that's something that we need to consider on how we bring that forward when we're trying to treat in place. And we need to start considering that as we're developing any guidelines and tools to help define what a treat in place model really looks like for this condition.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
You go to the next slide for me. So this is out of gastroenterology, and this is some recommendations that were made recently. This was published, and it just discusses the GI and liver manifestations of COVID-19, and what they're recommending is that we really need to monitor new onset GI symptoms as they can be associated with COVID-19. I believe when we first started getting research on this, you know, out of China, a lot of the studies showed that there was issues with the respiratory tract. Even when you look post-mortem and we started doing some assays and the tissue tropisms were more related to respiratory. We're now getting data that we're seeing these on the GI tract, on the liver, on the heart, kidneys. And so I thought this was interesting that they came out with this guidance currently. So they want the three main takeaways, I would say, the monitoring of the COVID-19 patients who haven't yet developed GI symptoms. You know, they want you to recognize that you should be monitoring it, identifying it as a new onset GI symptom, as a possible evidence that you may have COVID-19, and to really consider the impact of starting certain medications on the liver, because if this condition causes liver injury, adding a medication that can exacerbate that is worrisome. They also did recommend, they said their recommendation was, we do not recommend stool testing for COVID-19. So just in case someone had that question. If you go to the next slide for me. So this is out of one of our, the nephrology journal, Journal of American Society of Nephrology. And it really discusses renal involvement and early prognosis in patients. And they looked at 333 hospitalized patients. They found that 251 out of that 333 had either an abnormal urine dipstick, which was defined as either protein in the urine or blood, or acute kidney injury. So what they noted is that there is a higher mortality with any renal complication. But for those who do approve, usually that improvement with the renal and acute kidney injury happened over the course of 3 weeks after the onset of symptoms. So I thought this was pretty interesting, and I think it's something that we just need to pay attention to. This was done in the sickest of the sick, so the COVID-19 patients who had pneumonia in the hospital. I am looking forward to seeing information come out on the mild to moderate individuals with COVID-19 to see if there's any change in their renal status. The next study that I wanted to go to recently came out in the New England Journal. It is the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system inhibitors in patients with COVID-19. And, you know, this is this study sort of, I think, materialized because we had the question on should we keep the patients on ACEs and ARBs. And it is interesting. If you go to the diagram on the next slide for me, Shane. So what we've learned in these past few months is that COVID-19, coronavirus 2, has an affinity for binding to ACE2, which is the receptor. That then means that, you know, it is binding, and that's the port of viral entry. So what we were initially concerned was what happens if there's an uptake and we have somebody on these drugs, what then happens? What we're learning is that there is a actual down-regulation of those receptors when the person has COVID-19. So the concern that we initially had is now being replaced with the concern of what happens when you stop them, because we are more concerned that if you stop these drugs, we're going to have instability of the system, because now you're going to have, with the down-regulation, you could have elevated levels of angiotensin 1 and 2, which can lead to acute lung injury, myocardial issues, vasoconstriction, and vascular permeability. So this sort of supports why the recommendation from the cardiology societies and, I think the American Medical Association, the AOA, was to continue with ACE inhibitors and ARBs in place because we want to reduce any instability. So this is a really interesting study, and this also will be added to our COVID-19 library. We're going to keep going in the interest of time to alter renal status at COVID-19. So this was a question, I believe, at our last journal club. And I was looking for some information to help formulate an answer. I know we had some cases, and I do thank everybody who spoke up. But I was able to find, a couple of publications that are now identifying this and speaking about this. The first is in the American Journal of Geriatric Society. If you go to that, this is a level set with everybody. You know, like I said, we're getting a lot of information, so not everything is yet in publication status where you can read it in the journal. This is a pre-proof article, so it means that it has been accepted, it has been reviewed, it is in the proofing stage, and so the article that they shared is the rough draft. The highlight of this was that they said that the altered mental status was seen as a first sign in patients who had dementia. The problem that I'm hoping that maybe they'll resolve by the time it goes to actual print, or it'll be resolved with other future publications, is that they only identified 4 patients with COVID-19 and in this study. So, you know, it was one of those things. I know there's been a lot of talk about peer-reviewed articles and articles, the quality of the journal articles we're seeing. It's just a sign of the time that we're just hungry for information. So, you know, I think it's something that we would all anticipate. I don't know if this study does a good job of answering this, but in the next study that came out of the Lancet, it was looking at the presentations of patients who had COVID-19 and comparing it to patients who had SARS and MERS. So they then found that in COVID-19, delirium is in a significantly higher proportion in the acute stage than the other two viruses. And they really, like I said, they compared presentations, and it was a meta-analysis, so they compared presentations here to presentations with MERS and with SARS. So I thought that was interesting. There is more to come, and we will definitely put this in our library as well. Moving along, you know, I want to talk a little bit about treatment, and you know, I'm actually going to steer clear of the whole of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine today, because there hasn't been any new information, really. When the studies that I've seen so far really sort of, we still need more evidence, we still need more information. There is a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine that talks to the fact that it appeared to be a benefit with these drugs. So despite what you may have heard in the news about utilizing it as a prophylactic, you know, there is no evidence for that. And if you're like me, you may have received 100 phone calls from your family members, but there is no evidence to prescribe that for prophylaxis. What we are seeing, though, is that the World Health Organization, they launched their global solidarity project. This looks at lopinavir and ritonavir and remdesivir, as well as hydroxychloroquine alone. And it really is just looking at all of these drugs and try to get as much information pulled together so that they can make some better recommendations. If you go to the next slide for me, there are some early indicators that convalescent plasma is safe for patients with COVID-19. That's coming out of the Mayo Clinic. As of May 11th, they had 14,000 patients enrolled, and 8,900 of them were infused with convalescent plasma. The information that they were able to share was that the first 5,000 hospitalized patients who were transfused had a good result. And so we're looking forward to getting more safety information from them and more information on that, but that was some early indicators. If you go to the next slide, you know, this study has gotten a little bit more attention, and it's the adaptive COVID-19 treatment trial, also referred as the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease trial. In this study, 572 participants were studied, at 31% improvement on the primary endpoint of time to recovery was noted. I believe it was shared by Dr. Fauci, who leads the organization that sponsored the trial recently. So there is some positive results here. It is in phase three, you know, so I think that, and just to make sure everybody's aware, this is around remdesivir. So it is a phase three trial. So there's more to come and some really encouraging evidence coming out of this trial. The next study looks at what happens when we combine interferon beta-1b, lopinavir, ritonavir, and ribavirin in treating patients who are hospitalized with COVID-19. So they identified 127 people, participants, 86 were randomized to the combination therapy trial, and 41 were given a control. And the control was to just treat with lopinavir and ritonavir. And the combo group had a shorter time to a negative nasopharyngeal swab test. So that was their outcome. So this is a phase two trial, is something to watch and monitor for, you know, so some interesting things coming out of there. The next subject I wanted to hit upon was the race for a vaccine. You know, there has been a lot of manufacturers putting out some early data on what they're seeing. The first is Moderna, I believe is how you say it. It announced that they had positive results from their phase one of their trial. So in this study, participants received 1 to 3 doses on a 2-dose schedule. So that first dose could have been the 25 microgram, 100 or 150 microgram. After those 2 doses, though, And they're really reporting on the population who received 25 versus 100. All of the participants seroconverted with binding antibody levels that were greater than what we see in convalescent serum. So it is something that's encouraging. We are waiting to see what happens next. The next study or the next announcement came from Inivo. I believe I said that, may have said it wrong, but they're looking at a DNA vaccine. And I apologize, the one prior was RNA. They're looking at a DNA vaccine that was designed to produce a specific immune response. And they started with 40 healthy adults. They're hopefully we'll have some information by early to mid-June on how that trial is going. So, you know, and I know I'm giving you guys a lot of information, but I wanted to talk about the non-COVID-19 patients. You know, there's not a lot of data on what's happening, but I could just tell you there have been some information and you know, a lot of concern because we're not really seeing these patients utilize the health system as they were normally. And it probably is due in part to the fact that a lot of the elective procedures were canceled. But if you go to this first article, this came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it really is looking at it just discussing what is the effect to the patient without COVID-19, whether it's fear or concern of going to the hospital and then getting sick. You know, we really need to start thinking about the long-term consequences of not managing these patients in the way that they need to. There was some information that I heard in a news report that they are seeing increased incidents of people who are passing away at their home that are not related to COVID-19, that may have been a heart attack or something, but they didn't seek care. So I'm sure we're gonna get more information about that, but I just thought it was an interesting concept and something that we need to start thinking about and paying attention to. There is guidance from the CDC on what we need to do to make sure the system, make sure everything is healthy, like everything is safe for that non-COVID-19 patient. And, you know, I think we need to really consider that. If you go to the next slide, this came out of the advisory board, and this is really, the advisory board is directed to, you know, those CMOs and things in the community. So that organization really is geared to those, that medical leadership sector. What they're reporting is that the U.S. hospitals across the board are seeing fewer patients without COVID-19. You know, so it is something to keep an eye on. I know that in my line of work is something that we're keeping paying close attention to. If you go to the next slide, you know, I just want to make sure before we open it up to discussion that we take into consideration some things that we need to do, you know, to keep considering for ongoing preparedness. So the first study that I want to talk about recently came out in infection control of hospital epidemiology. It is, you know, Dr. Garr who came on to this, our weekly sessions a few, maybe a month ago, as some other leaders from AMDA wrote this up. And it really just speaks to what facilities need to consider and do, you know, first with really looking at what you need to have in place if you're going to admit a COVID-19 positive patient. Discussing how we should proceed with the admission process for anyone who's recovering with COVID-19. And I really appreciated like the detail that they went into. They stated that you need to have 2 negative COVID-19 tests on two consecutive days. You have to be A3 round for 48 hours, and you should not admit a patient who's still utilizing any level of ventilation support. I thought that was some good guidance. The third thing that they recommend is to screen any potential admissions. Screen any potential admission who you're concerned may have signs and symptoms, both typical and atypical of COVID-19. And if your facility is naive to COVID-19, you should not be admitting a new patient with COVID-19 or a readmission with COVID-19. The other thing to consider is the how do we coordinate with our hospital systems, local government, and state government. So if you get a chance, read through that. It's a very short commentary, but it was really highlighting the main issues that I think a lot of our facilities are facing. The final study that I'm going to mention comes from the American Geriatric Society. And it just talks about the perspective that CMS is taking. It also really goes through the policies and waivers that CMS put through and why they did that in an effort to really safeguard health and reduce spread and really assure well-being and quality of life. So, you know, we're gonna put this in, and I believe this too is one of those that are in the proof segment, so it's not fully published yet, but we'll get it into our library for you as well. With that, I will close this very long conversation with just a quote that states, "The breaking of a wave cannot explain the whole sea." I think that as we start looking at reopening, we really need to recognize that we're in a very unique setting of care, because we always deal with outbreaks or the fear of an outbreak or try to be prepared to prevent an outbreak. So, you know, our settings are different. And in the face of all the reopening and the, you know, the excitement over that, we need to always remain ready and careful, you know, be prepared. So with that, I'm going to open it up for discussion. And if you guys have any questions, comments, you know, please share.
Diane, it's Joe Auslander. Thank you for this amazing review. I don't know, understand. Just amazing, great resources. I have a specific question for the group. If anyone's knows a lot about viral testing and the characteristics. And it relates to a very interesting situation we're dealing with at a facility that I work in. So the question is, does anyone know, you may know, Diane, the false positive rate of PCR testing? I understand it can vary based on the manufacturer of the test, I believe. And it also can be positive in people who have had COVID, where it may be detecting viral fragments. But what I'm asking is, in somebody who hasn't had COVID, what is the false positive rate?
So I don't know that off the top of my head. I would have to look it up. I do know it's could be pretty high.
Yeah, I looked it up on the internet. I searched in many different ways, and the only thing I could find was one statement that said it's extremely low, like less than 0.02%.
Yeah.
But you'd have to have the virus or viral fragments in your body.
Yeah.
I think unless there's cross-reactivity or something.
Yeah, I think we were more concerned over the false negatives.
Yes. But let me just share with the group what has happened. Because it relates specifically to the guidance that's being given, just to illustrate how complicated this is. So we admitted a 95-year-old man the other day to one of our facilities who has not had COVID, to our knowledge. The hospital did, as we worked with our hospital, they had two negative tests done. And our policy is very conservative, so if the testing is available, even with two negative tests coming from the hospital, we do a test on day two and a test on day four. And in this person who came, no history of COVID, he had a negative test on day two in our facility. A positive test on day two in our facility, and then a negative test on day four. And what I think happened was in a department of the county department of public health suggested this as well, is that the test that you get from the hospital could be a few days old and people can still contract the virus before they get discharged to the facility. I think the first test that we did is a true positive, because I don't think there are many false positives. And the second test we did is a false negative. So I'm very concerned that he has the virus, but it's a confusing situation. You know, two negative tests coming from the hospital, then a positive test, then a negative test. It just shows you how confusing it can get.
Yeah, I think it is very confusing. And I know that was why there was a push to get the serology testing, because there is so much concern around the nasopharyngeal swab. Is it being done correctly? The false negatives, you know, Florida has a high false negative rate. We've tested in the state a lot of people, and the false negative rate, I do know, is high. And so there were some concerns around what we're seeing. So I think.
So this is interesting you mentioned that. So they had the pulmonologist that saw him in the hospital ordered a serologic test. I'm not sure that's going to be helpful in terms of what we're trying to do. We're trying to see if he is, the reason we're doing the test after they're admitted is to see if we can reduce the time they're in isolation safely. So the serologic test doesn't tell you that. It tells you that they've been exposed to the virus in the past. So it is just really complicated. So I don't know if anyone else on the call has any input on that.
Yeah, if you do, please speak up, because that is something, that's a very interesting case. I do know we had a question about anticoagulated patients in the nursing home. And I see that we had a response from Elizabeth. I don't know if I'm gonna say your last name, Bokwai. I don't know if you wanna share what you guys are doing in your facility. Not to put you on the spot.
You were close. It's Bukavi.
Bukavi.
Yeah, W said like a V. So I'm in a bigger facility with almost 200 people. And between myself and my nurse practitioner, we have been doing advanced care planning on these people before they were COVID positive back in March. And then having another conversation if people do develop COVID symptoms. And we've just been having discussions about potential, you know, management of COVID. I've found that, you know, if people are on aspirin or Plavix, and we talk about risk and benefits of anticoagulation at any stage, I think I've had one family member that wanted to be on anticoagulation, or even when we were talking about Plaquenil, that was actually accepting of it. So for most of my people, we're not anticoagulating. I am working with therapy to develop just mobility exercise programs for our COVID unit. So they are working on that just to reduce DVTs.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.